We have to save our water. We have to save our water. To keep on living. To keep on living. Our children need us to be thinking.
Our children need us to be thinking.
How we conserve for tomorrow. Save the water. Save the water. Save the water. Drop of water saved today. We'll make streams tomorrow.
We'll make streams.
So if we all do our part, we give our children a great start.
This is FM 90.1 KCFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Susan Chudy.
And I'm Stephen Chudy. Tonight's program is something of an ecotopian potpourri. Over the past couple of weeks, a number of news items and announcements have come to our attention, and we haven't been able to include them in the show. So tonight we're going to hopscotch the ecotopian universe with stories that include a hotel constructed out of recycled trash, a bikeway made from recycled printer cartridges, an announcement concerning a lawsuit affecting North State Water, and an editorial response to the president's handling of the Gulf oil catastrophe. Ecotopia is made possible in part by member contributions and by Cartridge World in Chico, specializing in printer cartridge refilling and remanufacturing for a green community. Cartridge World uses recycled cartridges for most home and business printers, copiers, and faxes. Cartridge World in Chico is located inside the Safeway Plaza next to Tri-Counties Bank. More information is available by calling 342-3333. And we are supported by Black Hawk Solar, presenting the 20th Annual Solar Cook-Off on July 9th and 10th at the Taylorsville Campground in Taylorsville, California. Over 10 live bands will be playing on Friday night and all day Saturday, with Earl Thomas headlining. Festivities include arts and crafts, solar-cooked food, and dancing on the Bouncing Grange Hall dance floor. Tickets are available at the door or by calling Black Hawk Solar at 283-1396.
And we want to remind you that the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll be back, right back, with an announcement from Aqua Alliance, the organization fighting to keep the North State water in the North State, right after this.
All day I faced a barren waste without the taste of water.
Cool water.
Old Ann and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water.
Water.
Cool
water.
Clear
water.
Keep
water.
A moving, Dan. Don't you listen
water.
To him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man. And he spreads
water.
A burning sand with water.
Water.
Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you? The shadows sway and seem to say, tonight we'll pray for water. Don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man. And he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you?
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. And tonight we're looking at a range of issues concerning social, technological, and environmental ecosystems. We begin with a July 1st press release from Aqua Alliance here in Chico. Listeners may recall that just a few weeks ago, we interviewed Jimmy Brobeck, a water researcher and analyst for Aqua Alliance, and he warned of efforts that are being made to bypass thorough environmental reviews by groups that want to transfer huge quantities of North State water to quench the insatiable thirst of the South.
Here's the Aqua Alliance press release. It reads, federal water transfers challenged in court. Sacramento Valley communities, farms, and fish in jeopardy. Aqua Alliance, the California Sport Fishing Protection Alliance, and the California Water Impact Network have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation to protect the economy and the environment of the northern Sacramento Valley. The Bureau's environmental assessment and findings of no significant impact for the 2010-2011 water transfer program reveals plans to export 395,000 acre-feet of Central Valley Project and State Water Project water to buyers south of the San Francisco Bay-Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. To replace the water sold to San Joaquin Valley growers in low-priority water districts, the plan would permit Sacramento Valley surface water right holders to substitute 154,237 acre-feet of groundwater to continue rice production.
As Jimmy Brobeck told us on Ecotopia, that's a vast quantity of water. By way of comparison, it's about half the annual Colorado River allotment to the city of Las Vegas. Imagine watering a city half the size of LV right here in the Sacramento Valley while maintaining full rice and other agricultural production. The Aqua Alliance press release continues. The plaintiff groups allege that the materials submitted by the proposed water purveyors violate the National Environmental Policy Act because, among other things, they contain a fundamentally flawed alternatives analysis and they inadequately analyze the impacts from implementing the two-year transfer program. The lawsuit seeks a comprehensive environmental review for the water transfer program. Repeated water transfer projects in the last decade have all occurred without the benefit of thorough federal or state environmental analysis, which would require the establishment of baseline conditions, comprehensive monitoring, and the disclosure of impacts.
The Aqua Alliance website also includes extensive background material on the case and on other efforts to draw down the water table in the Sacramento River Valley. There will be a public commentary opportunity, including a July 14th hearing at the Chico Public Library from 1 to 3 p.m. Again, that's July 14th, Chico Public Library, 1 to 3 for public commentary. We encourage listeners to check all this out on the website, aqualliance.net, and that's 1A, A-Q-U, 1A in the middle, A-Q-U-A-L-L-I-A-N-C-E.net.
The website also provides a link to this fascinating editorial from the Monterey County Herald, which challenges the argument that farmers in the San Joaquin Valley need all that water from the north. And that the editorial reads, "The sky hasn't fallen over water allotment reduction." They write, "Let's return for a moment to last spring when doom and gloom descended on the San Joaquin Valley in the form of water allotment reductions that, we were told, would bankrupt the farmers, idle the workers, and turn the region into a modern dust bowl. Perhaps you remember when TV commentator Sean Hannity, with ample PR help from the huge Westlands Water District, went on the air with a series of heart-tugging stories about how farms and jobs were being lost because wrong-headed environmentalists and federal officials were diverting valley water to protect insignificant smelt and salmon. In western Fresno County, the bedraggled farm town of Mendota provided the perfect backdrop for photo opportunities featuring busloads of sad-eyed field workers supposedly thrown out of work by the likes of the Sierra Club. Unfortunately for the recreational and commercial fishing industries and others with an interest in keeping the environment in balance, Hannity and other easily misled news operations largely missed the story about the dramatic decline in the salmon population caused largely by San Joaquin Delta pumping schedules that traditionally favored field crops over fish. Well, guess what? Farm income did slip last year in Fresno County by 75%, 50%, try 4.5%.
The editorial in the Monterey County Herald continues. The county-by-county annual crop reports came out this week, and Fresno County retained its title as King of California Agriculture, producing $5.4 billion in receipts. "I don't know how ag did it, but they did it," said Fresno County Agricultural Commissioner Carol Hafner. "This is our third year of more than $5 billion in value." It really is not a mystery. The growers did it by relying on water allotments that had been hoarded, by turning on their own pumps, and by raising prices. It is significant that the neighboring counties of Kings and Tulare saw much sharper declines in farm income, 25% and 19% respectively, but not because of lost irrigation water. Dairy is a large factor in those counties, and wholesale milk prices plunged in 2009. To be fair, the editorial goes on to say, it certainly was a tough year for Fresno County agriculture. A small portion of the federally subsidized water was indeed lost to the fisheries. So farmers scrambled to change crops and planting patterns. Some fields were taken out of production in order to protect recent large investments in tree crops, including big water users such as citrus, almonds, and pistachios. Times certainly were tough in dusty Mendota. Times have always been tough in Mendota. Almost assuredly, the income of Fresno County farm workers dropped more than 5.4% overall decline in farm income. But times are tougher yet along the docks and harbors of California, where the salmon harvest has been wiped out by a water delivery system dominated by ag interests and aided and abetted by Hannity and others who wouldn't want the facts to get in the way of a sad story.
Obviously, the Monterey Herald is more interested in fishing and sports than in the fate of the water table in our North State. But this editorial helps to rein in the notion that without northern water, the California agricultural economic engine will grind to a halt. We recommend that you read that editorial. You can access it through the Aqua Alliance website, and we've posted the direct link on our own website, ecotopiakzfr.net.
And we'll be back with more editorial opinion, this time on the Gulf oil spill, right after this.
Singing of North Sea oil from his Stormwatch album. In this segment of Ecotopia, we'll be interested in Southern oil, the BP Gulf oil spill, and we want to offer a sampling of editorial opinion.
From the Times Union, Albany, New York, comes this editorial dated June 17th. Beyond the Gulf, a new course. The most telling words spoken Tuesday about the Gulf of Mexico oil spill didn't come from President Obama, but from an oil executive, ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson. He said, "When these things happen, we are not well equipped to deal with them." He acknowledged this at a House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee hearing. It's as good an argument for the president's moratorium on offshore drilling as we've heard lately. Some might say Mr. Tillerson was stating the obvious 2 months into a disaster that continues to spew upwards of 2.5 million gallons of crude into the Gulf each day. But many still needed to hear it, particularly those who want to believe or at least assert that the disaster could have been stopped by now if only BP was more committed to plugging the leak, or the president was more forceful, as if this was a matter of sheer will.
The Times Union editorial continues, "The reality is the oil industry is in way over its head in deep water offshore drilling, and so are we all. For too long, we have allowed the issue of offshore drilling to be reduced to just another political disagreement, as debatable as whether one likes the Yankees or the Red Sox. What's leaking out of BP's well a mile underwater? What's washing up on beaches and killing fish and other wildlife isn't an opinion. It is evidence of the current limits of human technology. It's a matter of fact. Yet already, even some residents and officials in the Gulf region are saying Mr. Obama's moratorium, which suspends 33 drilling operations and holds off any new well permits, is too onerous because it will only further damage their economy. We appreciate how serious it is to shut down a source of livelihood for so many people and stop exploration in an oil-rich region that supplies a third of the nation's needs. But just imagine how different the world would be today if, on April 19th, the federal government had realized how inadequately prepared the industry was to deal with an accident and shut down drilling. America would not have an environmental catastrophe, one that will take years to clean up, on its hands. The nation cannot risk another.
The editorial from the Albany Times Union continues. Mr. Obama was right to order a six-month moratorium. He should extend it for as long as it takes the oil industry to prove it can fix its mistakes and accidents, and to be able to do it in a matter of days, if not hours. And Congress needs to learn the lesson of the Gulf and move forward with a new national energy policy that heeds the president's call, not at all different from other calls we've heard for decades, to tackle our addiction to fossil fuels. A policy that redirects our energy, if you will, to more efficient buildings, factories, and means of transportation, and to developing and refining sources of energy that don't cause problems we can't fix. Again, that editorial from the Albany Times Union, and we have posted the link at ecotopiakzfr.net.
And far away, coming from the Anchorage Daily Statesman, is this story concerning the BP by reporter Lisa Demmer and reported in the McClatchy newspapers. She asks, is it time to consider barring BP from federal oil leases? She writes, the federal government should consider barring oil giant BP from drilling on federal land or holding on to its existing leases, says a recently retired federal attorney who spent years dogging BP's operations in Alaska. There comes a point in time where we say enough is enough, said Jean Pascal, who worked for 18 years as a Seattle-based attorney for the EPA. Because, she said, BP has definitely turned into a major serial environmental criminal. Pascal said that BP has been convicted of environmental violations three times since 2000, twice in Alaska, and that the April 20th Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf of Mexico that sparked what President Barack Obama calls the biggest environmental disaster in the nation's history fits a pattern of behavior. She said BP got off too easy when it was allowed to plead guilty in 2007 to a misdemeanor for a record North Slope spill in 2006. No individual was charged.
The Anchorage Daily Statesman editorial tells us that Scott West agrees. He was the EPA special agent in charge of the criminal investigation division in Seattle that investigated BP's Alaska operations. He said, the people who are making the decisions are playing fast and loose on that Gulf rig. Hurry up. We are over time. We are over budget. Let's take the shortcut. If they'd seen some of their peers go to jail for these kinds of decisions, maybe they would have said, you know, my bonus this year just isn't worth it, West said, referring to congressional allegations that BP cut corners to save money on the Deepwater Horizon project. Both West and Pascal have been speaking out publicly since their retirements. BP keeps saying that they follow safety protocols and safety is their goal and health is their goal and the environment is their goal, Pascal said. But look at the record. That record includes a felony conviction in 2000 for failing to report immediately illegal dumping of hazardous waste by a contractor in its Endicott oil field in Alaska's Beaufort Sea. The punishment? 5 years probation, $7 million in fines and civil penalties, and another $15 million to create an environmental management system. A misdemeanor conviction in 2007, stemming from the biggest oil spill ever on Alaska's North Slope. In March 2006, a BP worker discovered crude leaking from a corroded Prudhoe Bay Transit pipeline, 200,000 gallons in all. BP, which admitted that its system for monitoring and preventing corrosion was inadequate, was put on 3 more years probation and ordered to pay $20 million in fines and penalties. A felony conviction last year for a 2005 Texas City, Texas refinery explosion that killed 15 people, injured another 170, and devastated a community. BP Products North America, Inc. was fined $50 million and put on 3 years probation.
The Anchorage paper also continued, quoting Pascal, who said there were other ruptures, explosions, and near misses over the years, plus a propane price-fixing case in the Midwest that BP settled with a deferred prosecution. West said he thinks that BP made a conscious decision not to invest in aging infrastructure for North Slope fields with declining oil production. We kept hearing a phrase called operate to failure, a reference, West said, meant that critical systems and equipment were operated until they broke down instead of maintained. The federal investigators in the Texas City case were, quote, finding the exact same patterns of neglecting worker safety and environmental concerns just to save a few dollars. West continued, that, of course, indicated to us that it was corporate-wide. It wasn't just isolated to a particular operating unit.
The editorial goes on to say that BP insists that it puts safety first and is following up on what it promised to do after the 2006 Alaska spill. As we said at the time, BP holds its environmental responsibility as a core corporate value, BP spokesman Steve Reinhart said in an emailed response to questions. We made and continue to make, he said, significant improvements in our integrity management programs. Before she retired in March, Pascal specialized in debarment, a process in which companies are prohibited from federal contracts because of environmental crimes or performance issues. It's time-consuming, complex, and even when successful, might not prevent a company from operating, Pascal said.
Pascal and West have both argued that for a company the size of BP, whose quarterly profits are measured in the billions of dollars, the fines have been minuscule. To me, the wrong message has been given to BP, West said. The message is you're protected. You are beyond prosecution. And again, that piece of reporting was by Lisa Demmer, writing for the Anchorage Daily News, and we've posted the link at ecotopiakzfr.net.
And finally, as we sample stories from and editorials concerning the oil spill, comes this editorial from the Washington Post, urging us to put the spill into a larger context of national energy policy. The article is called Obama's TV speech undersells how energy policy must change, from the Oval Office. President Obama argued that the catastrophic oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico underscores the need for America to transition from fossil fuels. But even as he attempted to rally Americans by invoking heroic American achievement in World War II and in space, the president didn't talk much about what could make such a transition happen. The answer is that oil, gas, and coal have to become more expensive to spur research into cleaner energy and encourage efficiency and switching. This could be achieved with a gradually rising tax on fossil fuels or a cap and trade system that makes utilities and others pay to pollute. The government could rebate most of the proceeds directly to Americans and invest the rest in energy research and transition assistance. When a price is placed on burning dirty fuels, market forces will drive the sort of transition Mr. Obama proposes.
The Washington Post continues, the president knows this. In other speeches before and after the Gulf spill, he has argued for it. Yet on Tuesday, he only hinted at this and seemed to suggest that he'd be open to energy legislation that doesn't raise the price of carbon. For that, Republicans bear considerable blame. To be consistent with both science and their philosophy, they should favor a market-based approach. Most on the national stage instead prefer irresponsibly to pillory the idea as job-killing national energy taxes. They propose command-and-control energy programs that they think might be more popular. Democrats with ties to coal or manufacturing interests, meanwhile, dilute the policy, demand payoffs to support it, or short-sightedly oppose it. Legislators in both parties champion more federal spending for their favorite technologies.
The editorial from the Washington Post concludes, but the harsh political climate is that all the more reason why presidential leadership is essential. Passing comprehensive climate legislation isn't likely to be easier in the next Congress. As the president begins to push on crafting a compromise energy proposal next week, he'll have to be more forthright on what true change will require. And again, that editorial is from the Washington Post, and we posted the link at ecotopiakzfr.net. And we'll be back with more Ecotopian news and information, including an update on the Plastiki, after a short break. This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1, community radio serving Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
Singing the Pacific Ocean Blues, reminding us to appreciate our oceans. Meanwhile, deep in the southern hemisphere is the Plastiki, the catamaran constructed from recycled plastic bottles that it is wending its way to Sydney, Australia. At noon today in the North State, it was 6 a.m. tomorrow morning in the South Pacific, and the Plastiki was nearing Sydney at minus 22 degrees latitude, 116 degrees longitude. The temperature at 6 a.m. at sea was 55 degrees Fahrenheit, and the Plastiki was proceeding at 0 knots, suggesting the winds were pretty flat. The crew has been at sea now for 109 days, and they've logged 6,944 nautical miles since leaving the West Coast.
Listeners may recall that we have conducted two interviews with Joe Royal, the skipper of the Plastiki, and we're hoping to have a conversation with her after the Plastiki lands in Sydney in a few days. Meanwhile, we've been following her blog and want to read a couple of interesting entries. This one about a torn sail written just a few days ago. Just as the night, this is Joe Royal, skipper of the Plastiki. Just as the night really fell in, just as the off watch had finally drifted off to sleep, which is always tricky straight after dinner, just as I had made Matt and Max a yummy hot chocolate, the treasured last jar, bang. "Why is the sail flapping?" Max said immediately, as I asked Mr. T to come and help me. The head sail had ripped along one of the seams two-thirds of the way up, leaving us with a flying jib flapping in the air. It was fairly windy with a 2-meter swell running through, so Max bore down wind to ease the pressure in the sail, as well as limiting the waves over the heads of T and I on the foredeck. On a normal boat, bringing down a ripped sail and swapping it out for another one would not be such a big deal. But the plasticky keeps us hot on our toes, as she will only allow a couple of minutes without flying a head sail before she rounds up into the wind and tacks. Then tacking back is such a big deal. On the way from San Francisco to Christmas Island, it once took us 5 hours to jibe the boat back round. Last night, with Max on the helm, several of us ran around preparing the hoist of the new sail before dropping the one now flying in two pieces. The bows are so narrow, it is tricky working two sails at a time up there. Smooth maneuvers, and we were off sailing again in no time. An afternoon of stitching today, and we are now ready in case the same thing happens again.
Joe Royal's blog continues the morning after the sail replacement episode. She writes, "This morning as I was cooking up some breakfast using last night's leftover rice to make rice cakes, egg, and Bill's yummy dried kale, I was just about to serve it up and I decided that a sprinkle of cheese on top would do just the job. On reaching the jars in the cupboard, underneath one of the saloon benches, I was greeted by a whole host of uninvited passengers, various species of maggots, the whole story of the evolution of maggots all hosted in one cupboard, sharing the same 20 by 15 foot cabin space as the seven of us. Ow! I quickly forgot about the cheese, closed the cupboard, and served breakfast before sharing the treat with everyone. We then got to work, boiling pans and pans of hot water, lifting every jar, about 100, out of the cupboard and on the deck into the process line of the various buckets to be cleansed. First step, to be immersed in boiling hot soapy water, next to be wiped, then scrubbed around the rims with a toothbrush. They were clingy little critters. One of the jars of beef stew had smashed. There were still some chunks of meat in it, with the remainder of the sauce all over the jars below. My body shivers as I think about reaching in for the broken jar, crawly things all over it. At watch changeover, Vern stepped in to save the day. He proceeded to spend about 3 hours ensuring every maggot went swimming. He then cooked dinner. A tired bird joined us tonight for dinner tonight, circling the boat for about a half an hour before successfully landing on the tri-attic, putting any trapeze artists in the Cirque du Soleil to shame. And we've posted the link to Joe Royal's blog on our website. You can learn more about the voyage at theplasticky.com. And we are hoping to have an interview with Joe once she reaches Australia in a few weeks.
We'll take a short break and be back with some trash and recycling news.
Talk to you about what we can do for planet Earth, and it goes a little something like this. Check it out, trash can wrapped in, we're here to say that's how you should throw your garbage away. Don't throw it in the sea or on the dam, do the right thing and throw it in the can.
Trash can wrapped,
trash can wrapped, trash can wrapped,
trash can wrapped,
trash can wrapped,
trash can wrapped,
trash can wrapped.
Our lands, your lakes and seas. You know what they're doing to our trees? They're cutting them down to the ground, making more factories in our town. Stop pollution, stop pollution, stop pollution, stop, 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 stop. Pollution, stop pollution, stop pollution, stop.
Trash can wrap, trash can wrap.
You wanna know something that's really a drag? It's using those plastic garbage bags. Plastic is no good for this atmosphere. It won't break down for a few hundred years. So when you're out shopping at the store and they offer you a bag, say no more. Bring your own bag, bring your own bag, bring your own bag.
No thank you, I have my own bag.
Sing it.
Trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap, trash can wrap.
Trash can wrap.
You wanna know something that's really cool, man? You can recycle your aluminum soda can. Recycle your paper cans and trash. It's a really easy way to make some extra cash. Recycle, recycle,
recycle,
reduce. use, reuse, recycle.
Trash can wrap.
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 Trash can wrap. Trash can wrap. Trash can wrap. Hand in hand, we gotta make a stand. Let's come together and clean up the land. Every one of us needs to do our part. Not tomorrow, but now. We must start.
Start, start.
You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we're bringing you a variety of news items about ecological issues. With all the discouraging news coming out of the Gulf of Mexico, it's useful to have a few stories that show there is a deep concern for the environment and that people are taking positive steps to improve our world.
Let me raise and a writer at Newsdex. An Australian website brings us the news that an Australian national park just got a little more green. It built a new bike pathway with recycled printer cartridges. The Simpsons Gap bicycle path stretches 10.5 miles inside the West MacDonald National Park. The pathway was made with recycled plastics and printer cartridges. The national park is located in the central part of Australia and is over 1,200 miles away from Melbourne. According to the Northern Territory government, the project was completed by local contractors for $330,000 and is part of a tourism stimulus package. Here at Simpsons Gap, repairs and upgrades to the bike path bridge are now complete, says Parks and Wildlife Minister Carl Hampton. He says it leaves a safer bridge for riders with a great natural aesthetic. In keeping with our government's commitment to sustainable development, the bridge is made from recycled plastic decking, saving landfill, trees, and ensuring a longer life with less maintenance. Every year, more than 120,000 people visit the magnificent West MacDonald National Park, and by investing in our parks, we are able to ensure visitors have a unique experience while we protect the environment. And according to the Australian National University, over 80% of used toner cartridges are actually thrown in landfills. They also report that Australians throw away 18 million cartridges every year. Currently, there is a program called Cartridges for, the number 4, Planet Ark in Australia. The organization that initiated the recycling program, Planet Ark, released a research study in April about the continent's recycling habits. The research found more than 90% of Australians correctly dispose of everyday household recyclables, but when it comes to recycling e-waste, electronic waste, such as printer cartridges, almost 50% of people are getting it wrong. So said Planet Ark's campaign manager, Brad Gray. Brad continued, "It's really encouraging that most Australians recycle their paper and plastic packaging, but when it comes to e-waste recycling, we have a long way to go. Printer cartridges are complex items which are unable to be recycled alongside everyday household waste," he added. "When we put the wrong items in a household recycling bin, we contaminate the entire contents of the bin and reduce the effectiveness of the whole recycling process." That story comes from Newsdex.org, and of course, we know that there are cartridge recycling programs of various kinds here in the North State that we can all use to advantage so we too can do the right thing. And that article is posted at newsdesk.org. We've put the full link on our website.
Another intriguing story from Newsdesk is the story of a trashy hotel written by Natalie Ornstein. Rome is home to the Pantheon and the Colosseum, but last week the city added something entirely different and trashier to its architectural repertoire. A temporary hotel built almost exclusively from trash collected on Italian beaches was open for business June 3rd through 7th. German artist H.A. Schultz told the Times Online that he built the hotel as a mirror of our time. He sees his work as a call to action, he said. We must change the world before the world changes us. Schultz's Trash People installation has been on display at several international landmarks, but this is his first trash building. The project was sponsored by Corona's Save the Beach campaign, which asks Corona customers to nominate and vote on European beaches to be salvaged. In order to recover at least one beach annually, the hotel, which was built in the gardens of the Castel Sant'Angelo and just across the Tiber River from Vatican City, is composed of 12 tons of collected garbage, such as plastic bags, beer cans, discarded cameras, and lost clothing. Guests include winners of a Corona contest, Danish supermodel and environmentalist Helena Christensen, and others who booked their stays far in advance of the June 13th premiere. June 3rd, that was. Christensen is a spokesperson for Save the Beach campaign. "I am deeply disturbed by the state of our beaches," she said in an interview with The Times Online. She said that she had a great night in the hotel and commented in a BBC News report that her experience made her, quote, "really wonder what made a human being throw away on a beach." H.A. Schultz's 1,000 trash people have traveled the world to raise awareness of environmental issues. Schultz and company are not the first to dabble in residential recycling. In 2008, German artists Volker Kaeberling and Martin Kaltweiser built the Cambridgeshire, England, Finland pavilion from waste and unwanted doors and windows. With their approach, that same waste, often going to costly landfill, can be rebuilt, recycled, reused, and recreated to make something not only beautiful but functional. Schultz Creation is the first trash hotel, and its debut coincided with World Environment Day. "We are in the trash time," he told AFB. That is also at newsdesk.org, and we will post the whole link on our website.
You can also ask your search engine to look for images. Just Google or Bing in Trash Hotel Italy, and you get a picture of that hotel. It's not a huge building. It has a lovely canopy out front. It's actually only a three-bedroom hotel, so it's not a vast contribution to the whole hotel population in Italy. But interesting to see how they've compacted the trash to create a structure. And now moving toward another part of the world, a kind of good news, bad news story about trash removal on, of all places, Mount Everest. It's not just the bodies of frozen climbers that catch your attention in Mount Everest death zone. It's also the staggering amount of trash, and an estimated 10 tons of it. Just as staggering is the notion that an expedition is now en route to begin a cleanup. Scattered along the southeast ridge route, the most popular ascent route on the 29,035-foot mountain, there are ropes, tents, oxygen cylinders, inessential packaging, batteries, medicine, and lots of other stuff, including bodies. A team of 20 Nepalese Sherpas was planning to work above the 26,000-foot level in the death zone, so-called because of the thin air and treacherous conditions. This expedition, the report explains, was scheduled to take place in late April and early May. The expedition hoped to retrieve five bodies, including American Scott Fisher, who died in 1996, and Swiss mountaineer Gianni Goltz, who died in 2008. We don't want to be ghoulish here, but the report continues. Scores of corpses preserved by the freezing temperatures remain on the mountain, some for decades. After setting up camp on the South Col, the team climbed to the summit of Everest and then began working its way down, picking up trash as they go. Seven-time Everest climber Namgyal Sherpa is running the expedition. He said this is the first time anyone has cleaned up rubbish in the death zone, but that it is important to do so to preserve the environment and make the mountain safe. "I'm a climber, and I can say frankly that I'm a little bit angry when I climb Mount Everest because of the rubbish," he said. "As for the bodies, I have seen three corpses lying there for years," he said. Others are a bit more nonplussed, given the sheer horror of it. It was a sobering experience to hear about people dying even as we continued to climb. In fact, as we made our way up the trail, we passed a dead climber whose frozen body looked as if it had been lying there for several years. So recalled Alan Mallory on his family's website, and who was 23 at the time of the climb. Bodies that are lying so close to crevasses or cliffs are sometimes pushed over so there aren't corpses littering the trail. It sounds grim, but that's the way it is. Because of the lack of oxygen, freezing temperatures, and punishing conditions, the Sherpas say they will not be able to carry more than 44 pounds per person, and that they will spend no longer than 12 hours above the 26,000-foot level. They plan to stay at the South Col for 1 week, making several returns to the death zone before coming back to base camp, resting, and then repeating the operation twice more. As many as 400 people each spring and fall attempt to climb Mount Everest, and the increase of adventurers has led to an increase in litter, especially along the southeast ridge. The trail consists of a base camp at 17,000 feet and four additional camps closer to the summit. Since the first successful expedition, at least 50 tons of trash accumulated. This expedition is not the first to target the 50 tons of trash on Everett, but it certainly is the highest attempt.
And in a follow-up story, Ang Churin reports in the Nepali Times, the 2010 spring mountaineering season from Nepal side has been very successful. My son Dawa Stephen, leader of Eco Everest Expedition 2010, and his team members returned to Kathmandu at the end of May safely and in good health. We were not able to learn how much trash the Eco team brought back with them, but in the past years, they have hauled off between 900 and 6,000 kilograms of stuff abandoned on the mountain. And we have links for both of those stories. And this one is www.nepalitimes.com. And we'll post that link on our website.
And that's it for Ecotopia tonight. We hope you've enjoyed or appreciated our potpourri of environmental stories on water, oil, trash, and even sailboats.
Next week on Ecotopia, we'll be talking with Carrie Crofton. She has written a new book about electropollution, radiation emitted by a range of electronic devices, including cell phones and computers.
Ecotopia is made possible by member contributions and by Cartridge World in Chico, specializing in printer cartridge refilling and remanufacturing for a green community. Cartridge World uses recycled cartridges for most home and business printers, copiers, and faxes. Cartridge World in Chico is located inside the Safeway Plaza next to Tri-Counties Bank. More information is available by calling 342-3333. And we are supported by Black Hawk Solar, presenting the 20th Annual Solar Cook-Off on July 9 and 10 at the Taylorsville Campgrounds in Taylorsville, California. Over 10 live bands will be playing on Friday night and all day Saturday, with Earl Thomas headlining. Festivities include arts and crafts, solar-cooked food, and dancing on the Bouncing Grange Hall dance floor. Tickets are available at the door or by calling Black Hawk Solar at 283-1396.
Coming up at 7 this evening is The Storyteller with your anthropological guide, Adrian Scott, bringing you stories, legends, and music from long ago and modern-day cultures. Join Adrian for a trip around the world exploring the hopes, fears, and dreams that are universal to all people. And at 7:30, it's All Mixed Up, bringing you 2.5 hours of rock and pop from the edges of mainstream and contemporary music, blurring the boundaries of most commercial radio. Stay tuned and enjoy a listening world that is all mixed up.
Thank you for listening to Ecotopia. I'm Stephen Chudy.
I'm Susan Chudy. Contact us at ecotopiakzfr at gmail.com or visit our website, ecotopiakzfr.net. You can also become our friends on Facebook and receive advance notice of upcoming shows.
Wheel me the sunshine out of the fall. Believe me, the hope of a new tomorrow, and fill my cup again.
Again now.
We need the sunshine out of the falling.
Out of the falling.
We need the hope of a new tomorrow, and fill my cup again.
Well, I've seen the steel and the concrete crumble.